Hall of Fame, the leaders and legends of the blindness field. Hall of Fame, leaders and legends of the blindness field, class of 2006 induction ceremony. Ann Sullivan Macy, Arnold Patz, October 13th, 2006, Louisville, Kentucky.
Marinell McLennan and Rick Welch have the honor of presenting two new inductees to the Hall of Fame, leaders and legends of the blindness field. Rick, Marinell.
Good evening. It truly is an honor and a pleasure for Marinell and I to have been invited to represent all of our colleagues in the formal induction into our Hall of Fame of two outstanding contributors to our field. This is truly our Hall of Fame. We appreciate the generosity of the American Printing House for the Blind in helping to establish the Hall of Fame, in so graciously hosting it in such a beautiful space, and in providing the staff support that it needs. But this Hall of Fame belongs to those of us who have worked in this field and have contributed to it. While this may seem a rather self-serving notion, we are the people who are in the best position to recognize who among our colleagues have made outstanding contributions to our field and the people we serve. As one of the Hall of Fame members, Warren Bledsoe, noted in 1966 when he wrote his credo ascribed to certain masters of the art of teaching blind people, quote, "The true apex of work for the blind is personal service in direct contact with blind people, and that all organized work for the blind has no other end but this, as fully and well prepared as available knowledge permits." It is within this spirit, as captured so well by Bledsoe, that we present for induction into the Hall of Fame two of our colleagues who have contributed outstanding, personal, and most of all, effective service to blind and visually impaired people across many generations. So at this point, I call upon my lovely wife, Marinell, to present Ann Sullivan Macy.
Thank you. There are times of grace in each of our lives when we are gifted with an opportunity to be part of something that puts us in touch with the rich legacy we inherit as practitioners in this important field. Tonight is one such occasion as we recognize and celebrate the accomplishments and the impact of Ann Sullivan Macy, the famed and fabled teacher of Helen Keller. Like other members of our Hall of Fame, Mrs. Macy left an indelible imprint that continues to influence our work today. But unlike most of the others in the Hall of Fame, whose contributions spanned their professional careers, her work literally lasted her lifetime. The life of Ann Sullivan Macy was a complicated and inspiring journey in and out of darkness. Hers was not the darkness that is a frequently used but questionable analogy for vision loss or blindness. The kinds of darkness that Ann encountered and conquered were the kinds of darkness that can kill one's spirit and paralyze one's growth and ambition. Yet this brave and indomitable person never allowed the trials and the tragedies of her own life to snuff out the sparks of her intelligence, to weaken the intensity of her commitment, or to melt the diligence of her drive and determination. Ann Sullivan Macy was not only a tireless and intuitive teacher, she was herself a survivor. To appreciate the breadth of her success, one must know the depth of her personal struggle. Annie was born in 1866 to an impoverished and illiterate family of immigrants in a village near Springfield, Massachusetts. She was the oldest of five children, only two of whom lived to adulthood. Education was out of the question for the Sullivan children, as was even modest medical care. By the age of seven, Annie was a hot-tempered, unruly child whose sight was deteriorating from untreated trachoma. When Annie was eight, her fragile family was splintered by the death of their young mother, who died from tuberculosis. The surviving three children were separated, and for 2 years, young Annie's life was one of servitude, her days spent cooking and cleaning for her alcoholic and irresponsible father. When he could no longer maintain even the barest abode and could offer no support for his children, Annie and her dear brother Jimmy were reunited, as they were institutionalized as wards of the state. It is difficult for us today to imagine the darkness of Annie's days at the Tewksbury Almshouse. She and Jimmy endured horrors and deprivation beyond our ken, but they were at least allowed to stay together in the ward for older women. That is, until tragically, Jimmy, the only person to whom young Annie felt connected, died a few short months after they arrived at the poorhouse. Alone, and in the midst of unspeakable filth and degradation, Annie's vision continued to deteriorate, but not her determination to survive beyond this hellish experience. After 4 dreadful years at Tewksbury and scores of pleas for release with only disappointing rejections, Annie was saved when she was admitted to the Perkins School for the Blind. Although unschooled until the age of 14, Anne Sullivan was an exceptionally quick learner. A member of the Perkins staff wrote, "She had the most powerful mind in the school, yet in reading, writing, arithmetic, manners, and diction, she was less developed than even the youngest child enrolled." And yet even Perkins was not the end of her darkness. Years in the poorhouse had ill-equipped Annie for normal life. Her tenure at Perkins was fraught with humiliation that stemmed from her lack of social experience. She was rebellious and scornful and difficult to befriend. She clashed with her classmates and her teachers alike. Understandably, feelings of fear and inferiority ruled her life. Looking back on those tumultuous years, Annie later described herself by saying, "My mind was a question mark, my heart a frustration." But slowly, Annie's defiant nature tamed, although she never lost her Irish stubbornness. She worked hard and graduated as the valedictorian of Perkins. After graduation, however, she was again utterly alone and homeless. About that same time that Annie graduated from Perkins and was wrestling with her uncertain future, the Keller family of Alabama reached out to Michael Anagnos, the director of Perkins, asking for help in addressing the needs of the increasingly violent, stubborn, and curious deafblind daughter. Mr. Anagnos made the quick and, in his own words, almost instinctive connection between the Keller's search for a teacher for their daughter and his talented but undirected former student. He brought Helen back to Perkins, where she immersed herself in studies to prepare to teach the unschooled, unruly, undisciplined 7-year-old Helen Keller. In 1887, the 21-year-old Annie Sullivan traveled to Tuscumbia, Alabama, where she lived with the Keller family and began the work that would become her destiny. Annie was Helen's instructor for 13 years, and led her through preparations for admission to Radcliffe College. In 1900, Anne accompanied Helen to Radcliffe, where she attended every class with Helen, spelled into her hand every lecture, demonstration, and assignment. After Helen's graduation from Radcliffe, a milestone for both women, Anne remained by Helen's side as mentor and companion. Through the years, despite Anne's worsening sight, bouts of depression, and the disappointment of Anne's failed marriage, the two women undertook national and international projects that included writing for publication, touring the vaudeville circuit, and starring in a Hollywood movie entitled Deliverance, based on Helen's life. The two traveled around the world and spoke publicly, raising awareness and funds for the American Foundation for the Blind. Anne Sullivan Macy remained Helen Keller's miracle worker until Anne's death in 1936. What was it that caused or drove or led this young woman to accept such a mammoth assignment in a place and culture foreign to her? And what caused her to devote her entire life to teaching this one talented student? Perhaps it was Annie's own experience of personal darkness that gave her insight into Helen's silent and isolated world, where Helen, too, had a mind that was a question mark, a heart that was a frustration. Perhaps it was Annie's personal struggle that enabled her to explore, to pursue, to endure, and to believe, and to become a brilliant and intuitive teacher. Anne Sullivan Macy was a survivor whose contributions survive and live in our work today. Her impact extends far beyond her teaching and life with Helen Keller. Her interactive and natural teaching methods and her insights into the learning needs of visually impaired and blind students are our legacy from this talented woman known to Helen as Teacher. For all this, we welcome Anne Sullivan Macy into the Hall of Fame. I will ask Stephen Rothstein, the director of the Perkins School for the Blind, to come receive the plaque for Anne Sullivan Macy. Thank you. Give it up.
That was beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I worked on that.
Thank you very much for those very moving remarks, and thank you both to APH and to the nominating committee. I'm truly humbled to be here. Well, this award is for Annie. In some ways, it's for each and every one of you, because each and every one of you are making a difference. Each and every one of you are creative, are hardworking, are making a profound impact on the lives of students. So this is for Annie, but I hope you think of it as also for you. And I know someday I look forward to coming to Hall of Fame when many of you are inducted at some point in the future. As we heard just now, I think we all know some about Annie, but there's a lot we don't know. We know about her hard work with Helen. We know about her amazing work that led to being called Teacher. Her legacy as immortal is probably the most famous special ed teacher in the world. And as I'm speaking, there are a series of still photographs on the screen, some of Anne and Helen together. But we don't know all of her accomplishments. She survived, as was just said, an impoverished and challenging childhood, medical disease and heartbreak. Her father abandoned her and her brother to a poorhouse in Massachusetts. And she would have stayed there except for her determination and her wisdom impressed folks from Perkins when they were coming through, and she was admitted there. Not everyone knows that when she was admitted to Perkins, she was illiterate. Not unusual for students to be admitted who were literate at that time and legally blind. 7 short years later, she graduated the valedictorian of her class. When Helen Keller's family wrote to my predecessor, Michael and Agnes, the second director, I'm the 9th in 178 years who've had the honor of guiding Perkins, that Michael and Agnes asked Annie to stay, and she stayed for several months studying the lessons and then went down to Alabama. Imagine those first few days in Alabama, young 7-year-old Helen and Annie trying to figure out what to do. But she was no ordinary teacher. They clearly figured it out. And not just in Alabama, and then when they came back to Perkins and Radcliffe and beyond, but as was said, she devoted her entire life. When Helen sat in a class at Radcliffe, Annie was there. When Helen and Aunt did great work for AFB, Annie was there. When she traveled around the world meeting presidents and prime ministers, Annie was there. In fact, when she was courting John Macy, her future husband, she said to John, if I ever have to choose between you and Helen, I'm choosing Helen. And unfortunately, she did. John and Annie got divorced, and an interesting historical side note, he later married another deaf-blind woman, but that's another story. But she stayed with Helen. If that story had happened today, there'd probably be a reality series based on that. Not just did she make a difference in Helen's life, but for over a century, she has impacted the way children who are blind and deafblind learn. There are universities teaching programs that weren't doing it. There are programs for the blind that weren't accepting students who are deafblind that today are doing it. In fact, there are schools named after Annie Sullivan that I'm aware of in 7 countries today, and probably a lot more that I'm not aware of, continue to make a difference. In addition to Helen's words, the other person who probably speak best about Annie is the author of The Miracle Worker, William Gibson. A few years ago, I had the distinct honor of spending an afternoon with him. He's in Western Mass, and he talked about his experience. And I'm going to show a brief tape of him talking about Annie Sullivan, and then it'll be followed by a very brief snippet of the video of the movie version, Miracle Worker, with Ann Bancroft and Patty Duke at the water wheel.
He has always focused on Helen in the play. And I point out that the play is called The Miracle Worker, not The Miracle Workee. And it was really Annie that I was smitten by. Helen was an extraordinary woman. I'm not diminishing that at all. But Annie brought the initiative into that. She was the one who brought the dramatic move into the situation. And she did it because she was an extraordinary person. You know, she was born not far from here, over in Feeding Hills, orphaned. Not really orphaned. I think her father ran away. She was brought up by an uncle and aunt with her brother until they either died or got tired of them, and then they turned them over to the almshouse at Tewksbury, which was a dungeon. And that's her background. Now, out of that, that such an act has happened in Tuscumbia in that first month should come is rather extraordinary.
The scene of the water wheel is being shown now with Patty Duke. Today, thousands of miracle workers, including everybody in this audience, are making an enormous difference, and in some ways, that is a tribute to Annie Sullivan. So on behalf of her, thank you again to APH and the nominating committee. Thank you to all of you for your work. And I know when we think of Annie Sullivan at Perkins, it reminds us of our expression, which is all we see is possibility. Thank you very much.
those of you with vision and good powers of observation, you may realize that the tie I'm wearing was up here at the podium last night around the neck of Bob Brasher. When I arrived on Wednesday evening, I realized that I had forgotten to pack a tie. Now, after listening to Dr. Patz talk about the impact of Bert Boyer's tie on those 200 European women, I thought I'd like to borrow that tie. But I found out that Bert went home and had it insured and now is not allowed to lend it to anybody. Last night you heard Bert talk about Dr. Patz, and you heard Dr. Patz talk about his own work, and there are beautiful write-ups about his career in the program, and there's not a lot left to say. So as a way to review, we're going to have a little quiz. If you take out a half sheet of paper and put your name up in the corner, 21 honors and awards, 240 peer-reviewed scientific papers, 235 books or book chapters. It's amazing what he's accomplished. But we're not here to talk about the quality of what he's done, even though that's remarkable, the quantity of what he's done, even though that's remarkable. We're really here tonight to talk about the quality of his work. By now, most of us know the story of how, as a young ophthalmologist, he made the observation that premature infants who were spending time in incubators with high concentrations of oxygen were more likely to experience severe damage to their retinas. He set out to demonstrate the connection between high oxygen concentrations and retinal damage in a small study conducted at DC Hospital. And as Dr. Patz told us last night, that this study was rejected for funding because the officials at NIH thought it had no scientific basis. As a scientist with faith in his own observations, he did not let that stop him. His faith was also tested by the reactions of many colleagues and nursing personnel who felt that oxygen-rich incubators for premature infants provided a life-saving benefit and could not possibly be the cause for this problem. The results of this first small study, which, by the way, is considered the first prospective clinical trial in the field of ophthalmology, supported his theory. And Dr. Patz then worked with Dr. Everett Kinsey as a key member of a committee that coordinated a well-funded 18-hospital study that confirmed the causal relationship between hyperoxia and what has come to be known as retinopathy of prematurity, or ROP. This finding changed the practice of caring for premature infants and significantly reduced the number of children who developed ROP. For this work, Dr. Patz and Dr. Kinsey received the Albert Lasker Research Award, which is considered to be the top award in American medical research. Working with physicists at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, Dr. Patz developed the first lasers to be used to photocoagulate the retina in the treatment of diabetic retinopathy, macular degeneration, angle closure glaucoma, and other ophthalmic diseases. Dr. Patz also played a leadership role in the development and the use of fluorescein angiography as a tool to diagnose diabetic and other retinopathies. He was responsible for establishing the Retinal Vascular Center at Johns Hopkins University and was influential in the training of many highly regarded retinal specialists. I think it is less well known that in addition to advancing his own field, Dr. Patz has also been instrumental in building bridges between ophthalmology and our own specialties of educating and rehabilitating people for whom medical science is not able to correct the vision problem. One of his colleagues and his role model for his work in this area was another member of our Hall of Fame, Richard Hoover. While serving as the director of the Wilmer Eye Institute and chairman of the Department of Ophthalmology at Johns Hopkins University Hospital from 1979 to 1989, Dr. Patz stimulated the development of a low vision research center and a low vision rehabilitation clinic at Wilmer Institute. He provided the personal leadership to raise funds for these projects, including working with Lions Clubs of Maryland, Delaware, and D.C. to create a foundation to support this effort, and personally driving around the states of Maryland and Delaware to visit Lions Clubs to ask for their support directly. For this work, Dr. Patz received the Lions International Humanitarian Award in 2005. That award, unlike this induction into the Hall of Fame, Dr. Patz, carried a $200,000 gift, which he directed to the endowment of the foundation and the rehabilitation clinic. As president of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, Dr. Patz created the vision rehabilitation section of the academy, oversaw the development of a preferred practice plan for low vision rehabilitation, and worked to include low vision rehabilitation as an integral part of residency training programs in ophthalmology. As you would expect, Dr. Patz has been honored by organizations in his own field and has received all the top honors in ophthalmology. It's significant to note this evening that Dr. Patz has been honored by many organizations in our own field as well. He was the first recipient of the Seeing Eye Research Professor Award. He was the first recipient of the Distinguished Scientist Award from the National Society to Prevent Blindness. He received the inaugural Helen Keller Prize for Vision Research from the Helen Keller Eye Research Foundation. He received a special award for landmark research in the prevention of blindness from AER, and he received the Peace Art Award from the Lighthouse International. For his many contributions to the field of ophthalmology, Dr. Patz received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2004 from President George Bush. This, of course, leads to the question, what does Arnold Patz have in common with Doris Day, Estee Lauder, Rita Moreno, Pope John Paul II, and his personal hero, Arnold Palmer? I'll give you a clue. The answer has nothing to do with his golf score, but they are the other recipients, some of the other recipients of the 2004 Medal of Freedom. At the heart of all these accomplishments is the concept emphasized by Dr. Gerald Luddy in his letter nominating Dr. Patz for the Hall of Fame. And I quote, "Dr. Patz has always put the patients first and attempted to provide them with the finest care, education, rehabilitation, and support systems to assist them in their lives with ocular disease. The quality of care that patients with diabetic retinopathy, retinopathy of prematurity, vein occlusions, and age-related macular degeneration receive today, and I add throughout the world, is due in part to the work of Arnold Patz." So as Mary Nell now shows you the copy of the plaque that will represent him in the Hall of Fame, I think you will agree with me that there was never anyone who was more deserving to be recognized in our Hall of Fame of leaders and legends in the blindness field than Dr. Patz. I invite you to welcome into the Hall of Fame.
I'll try to live up in my future to some of those wonderful things you said about me, but I find tonight an experience which to me is most memorable than anything that I can think of in my lifetime. And to be receiving this honor in the same time that Annie Sullivan is recognized in the Hall of Fame makes it very special, really super special. Last evening, I showed you a picture of Helen Keller with Dr. Everett Kinsey, who had done this oxygen study for the group of 18 hospitals that was testing what we'd done earlier. And if I could have that slide on the screen, if it's available. Good. I, with my vision, I'm having a little trouble reading the print on that statuette. And so, and my wife was very thoughtful. She brought in some enlargement. And what you will see is that on that statuette that I'm holding with my left hand and Ms. Keller's holding the upper part, you'll see in this enlargement that that statuette does not belong to me. That is a statuette that states on there honoring Dr. Jonas Salk for his polio work. And I can assure you that I know very, very little about polio as far as immunization for it. And but Helen Keller, being so astute, what she did is when she reached over to take the statuette as it brought it up, she reached too far and she took Dr. Salk's and not mine, which was to the immediate right. But she just scrolled in about a half a second and read the whole thing and then said to her companion, who had a left hand right beside her left arm, and she wrote to Polly, that this is not Dr. Patz's statuette, and it's Dr. Salk's. And so Polly Thompson writes back saying, oh, well, I'll have them change that immediately. Well, she said, and this is Polly Thompson telling me afterwards, when I was having this wonderful personal interview with her in the reception afterwards, she said that, don't you say one word about this being the wrong statuette, because I, Helen Keller, don't want to be humiliated. And she said, besides, Dr. Patz will never know the difference. Now, she meant that when she said he wouldn't, and she took my left arm, pulled my hand around, so that I was covering the bottom lines of the statuette. And it covered over the name. So when the photographers came along, she figured, well, that would be it, because they told her they're taking the pictures now. The only thing that the photographer, he insisted that Miss Keller would raise her arms and put it at the top of the statuette and not be holding my hand in place. And she resisted at first, and Polly Thompson said, no, you've got to do what he said. And therefore, her hands are on the top of the statuette, and she's not pulling my hand around. It was very uncomfortable, so I pulled my hand back just about an inch, so you can see half of the name, and you see Jonas, but you don't see Salk. I have that covered. Well, needless to say, that was a part of the problems I've had getting off on the wrong track in my career. But the reason I wanted to bring Ms. Keller into the discussion tonight is to have the marvelous privilege of being recognized with Annie Sullivan this evening. And Annie Sullivan came into our discussion and the reception afterwards as she was chatting with me through her companion. And it wasn't really a chat. She gave me a lecture. I mean, seriously, she liked to point, and Polly Thompson told me, she said, I'm putting her left arm against your right arm so she knows exactly where you're sitting, and don't move in the chair, particularly don't move your head and face forward, because she likes to point, and she doesn't want to poke you in the eye. So after about 10 or 15 minutes, she told me several important things, one of which was she said that you doctors should never tell the parents of a patient, she knew that I was working with children primarily as far as this condition, that when even though the child is totally blind, irreversibly blind, never tell them that nothing further can be done. She said, because there's always the opportunity for rehabilitation. And that's the way she spelled it out to Polly, so that I'd be sure to understand it. So Polly said, rehabilitation. Well, that was a good bit of instruction for me, and it stimulated me subsequently to really get seriously into the field of rehabilitation of patients with visual impairment, and that I owe all of that really to that really marvelous comment that she had made to me. And but she was very careful in saying, you doctors should not. Then she said, but wait, Dr. Patz, I know that you know better already, but pass that on to your colleagues. Well, anyway, she was just so marvelous. And then she asked me if I had any questions for her. And fortunately, and I never dreamed of tonight, this is exactly 50 years ago that occasion occurred. She said, do you have any questions for me? Name is for Helen Keller. And I said, well, I'd like to know a little bit more about your working with Annie Sullivan and how did it work out as far as school, particularly going on in advanced and going to college with her at Radcliffe. And she said, well, you know, I found that Annie Sullivan was very strict. In fact, she really was difficult for me to communicate with and work with because she was so strong and disciplined and so disciplining me and what we were doing. She said, but after 3 or 4 years, I realized how important that was because of how hostile and belligerent I was because of her total blindness, stone deaf, absolute silence, and about 97% to 96% of her speech having been lost when she developed what was then called brain fever, and that we know today as meningitis. But at any rate, she was very careful to let me know that as she got a little older, she truly appreciated what Ann Sullivan did and went on to explain how every single thing that Helen Keller accomplished almost, that Annie Sullivan really was a key player in that. So for that reason and nothing else, I am really overwhelmed to be recognized tonight with the late Annie Sullivan. And I want to close in thanking APB for this marvelous honor. And it's been a privilege for me to come to know many of the people here and to actually recently start working with some of the superstars. And I'll only mention one, Bert. who is the coordinator for the Baby Count Project. And so, Bert, I'm saluting you in my closing thank you to APB, and again, my very special thanks to all here.
Inspiring. We have one more recognition we want to make as we close this portion of the evening. There's an artist among us that we need to recognize and we need to say thank you. Andrew Dakin, please stand. Andrew is the artist who molds the remarkable bas-relief plaques of the two honorees tonight, as well as all of the other plaques, the 32 that currently hang in the Hall of Fame. Andrew holds a degree in sculpture from Murray State University and has worked as a commercial sculptor for 17 years, and he's our personal favorite. Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. Rick and I want to thank you for sharing with us the honor of being part of this very significant evening. And as we depart from the dais, we'd ask you to join us in one more round of applause for our honorees, Ann Sullivan Macy and Dr. Arnold Patz. Thank you.
Hall of Fame, the leaders and legends of the blindness field.